Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
There's not going to be enough protection for the village if water should be coming in from the Bering Sea. That's really scary.
Erosion from last week's storm has left Hooper Bay without protective sand dunes. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, September 28th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, Senator Lisa Murkowski asks the federal government for additional disaster funds.
I'm desperately hopeful that the administration hears us on that.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Eastern Interior Alaska Subsistence Regional Advisory Council invites public participation in a meeting to discuss fisheries closure reviews, proposals to change federal subsistence fish and shellfish regulations, and other subsistence-related issues on October 5th and 6th in Fort Yukon. More at 800-478-1456 or doi.gov/subsistence/regions. This message sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management.
Just a quick warning, this first story might be disturbing for some listeners. A Selawik man is accused of beating his pregnant girlfriend to death after an alcohol-fueled encounter overnight Sunday, according to Alaska State Troopers. 23-year-old Floyd Stoney is charged with second-degree murder and manslaughter of an unborn child in the killing of 18-year-old Kiera Foxglove. Troopers said her death was reported Monday morning in the Northwest Arctic Borough Village, about 90 miles east of Kotzebue. According to a charging document, Stoney told troopers he had passed out drinking Sunday night before visiting Foxglove. He said he found her and believed she had been drinking. He became angry and punched her in the face several times, the charges say. Foxglove was taken to the Selawik Clinic, where she was pronounced dead early Monday. Troopers arrested Stoney and took him to Kotzebue, where court records show he made an initial appearance in the case this morning. Two people died this week after a short time in Alaska Department of Corrections custody. The Alaska Beacon reports that brings the total number of in-custody deaths this year to 14. According to a press release from the Department of Corrections, next of kin have been notified and no foul play is suspected in either death. Of the 14 deaths to occur in corrections custody so far this year, several have taken place only after a short time in state care. Two deaths in August occurred after less than 24 hours. The number of in-custody deaths so far this year had already surpassed the 9 in-custody deaths that took place last year. Within the past 10 years, corrections saw the most deaths in 2015. 15 people died in custody that year. The Alaska State Troopers investigate every in-custody death, and the State Medical Examiner's Office determines the cause. Citing confidentiality, though, the state does not release medical information. Alaska's Congresswoman Mary Peltola spoke on the House floor just a little while ago to advocate for her first bill, which would establish an Office of Food Security in the Department of Veterans Affairs.
I rise today to speak on a topic of vital importance to my state, where veterans comprise about 10% of the population, and I know many veterans who face food insecurity.
The office would coordinate with the Department of Defense and the Department of Agriculture, which is in charge of the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. According to researchers from the RAND Corporation, veterans who are more vulnerable to food insecurity are those who are disabled, unemployed, and served in the years since 9/11. Peltola cited a study from a different think tank that said food insecurity among veterans is a national security concern, in part because it adds stress to military families and may harm recruitment.
I know this bill will not solve the problem entirely, but I believe it can help Alaska and throughout the country. I ask my colleagues to support H.R. 8888, and I yield back the remainder of my time.
Josh Wilson, spokesman for Peltola's congressional office, says Peltola's staff drafted the bill with the help from the House Veterans Affairs Committee. House Republicans did not argue against the bill. A vote is expected tomorrow. With the eyes of the nation on Hurricane Ian and the damage it's inflicting on Florida, Senator Lisa Murkowski says the people of Western Alaska should not be forgotten as they clean up from the storm that struck nearly 2 weeks ago. She, Senator Dan Sullivan, and Congresswoman Peltola have joined Governor Mike Dunleavy to request a waiver of the state's share of the disaster costs for the first month.
I'm desperately hopeful that the administration hears us on that, because for us right now, it's this immediacy of time to get things pulled back together as fully as we possibly can.
The federal government typically pays for 75% of eligible disaster costs. Murkowski, in a speech on the Senate floor this morning, said the storm damage in Alaska may not be as visible as that in Puerto Rico and Florida, but people lost winter food stores and freeze-up will soon make it much harder to bring in fuel and supplies to repair their homes. One long-term impact of the historic flooding that swallowed Hooper Bay last week is a dramatic loss of dunes. Those dunes form a natural seawall for the town, and without them, the town is exposed. KYUK's Will McCarthy went out with a middle school field trip to see how the coast has changed.
So let's go down over to that other dune over there.
On the beach in Hooper Bay, Daniel Cernick, a middle school science teacher, is working to wrangle a few dozen of his students. It's been less than a week since a powerful storm brought flooding and severe winds to the town of 1300. As part of his science class, Cernick wants his students to observe the coast and learn about erosion.
No, you need to think back! Before the storm, when you drove down the beach and you looked at the sand dunes that were like this, what was different between then and now?
The students are on the beach south of the village, where the storm surge was the strongest. The impacts of the storm on the coastline are all around the group. In parts of this area, what was once a stretch of rolling sand dunes is now a flat floodplain. There used to be five rows of dunes. Now, there's only one here. In other places, they remain intact. The beach itself has also shrunk. Before the storm, Cernick took measurements of how far the water was from the dunes. But with this field trip, he's trying to gauge how things have changed.
Yeah, they're gonna spread out just a few feet apart on the new coastline.
Hi.
And then we're gonna get the GPS data, they're gonna record it on their paper, and then we're gonna use that to build a map that's gonna have the old coastline and the new coastline overlaid on each other.
According to Cernick's calculations, the storm eroded about 300 feet of coastline, bringing the water that much closer to town. The loss of Hooper Bay's dunes has potentially serious consequences. Hooper Bay has minimal ground above sea level. The dunes, for so long, have protected the village from high water. Here's Emma Smith, a longtime Hooper Bay resident. She drove her four-wheeler down to the beach after the storm to get a sense of the impact. I spoke to her in the Tribal Council building.
That was traumatizing just by seeing how much the coastline has eroded. There are not going to be enough protection for the village if water should be coming in from the Bering Sea. That's really scary.
A 2014 assessment by the state of Alaska estimated that the coastline near Hooper Bay erodes about 5 feet every year. Floods like this accelerate that timetable. The airport, which is only about a quarter mile from the shoreline, is the infrastructure that's most at risk of erosion over the next few decades. But more immediately, storm surges threaten the safety of the whole village. Although no one was injured or killed in the storm, the flood caused serious property damage and destroyed the homes of multiple families. Experts say these storms are becoming more frequent due to climate change. Tom Ravens, a professor at University of Alaska Anchorage and an expert in coastal erosion, said oceans can be an extremely destructive force.
And the way it works is, you think about a wave. Those waves are building over, hundreds or thousands of miles. Those waves encapsulate just a ton of energy.
Ravens said Hooper Bay's dunes likely made the flooding less severe than it otherwise could have been.
The dunes can be considered like sacrificial elements. There's value in sort of rebuilding the dunes, even if the next storm is going to take them out. And the value is that they're preventing, to some extent, from the water from flowing from the ocean into the community.
Mary Hoschler, another lifelong resident of Hooper Bay, says she was already concerned about what erosion along the coastline meant for the village. With the loss of the dunes, it's hard for her to feel safe planning for her future here.
I think it's hard to think about, I wanted my kids to live here. I wanted to build them a house and live in Hooper Bay, reside in Hooper Bay. But it feels like we have to move.
Back at the beach, students are laughing and enjoying being outside of the classroom on a brisk sunny day, rushing in and out of the waves. For them, at least right now, this moment is a learning experience and a chance to process the trauma of the past week. But for adults, it's hard not to wonder what the loss of Hooper Bay students will mean for these students' future and the future of the town. Here's Hochler again.
I have no idea. This is just crazy and scary.
Reporting from Hooper Bay, I'm Will McCarthy.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Ketchikan High School's drama club earns the right to perform Disney's Frozen.
They are an open door, and they have been so accepting of anyone who wants to try this out.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
NEA Alaska is a professional education association representing over 11,000 of Alaska's dedicated public school employees. Their members are united in their commitment to provide an excellent education for every student, regardless of background or zip code. Together, NEA Alaska members work with colleagues, parents, and their communities to build strong public schools that are productive, safe, and welcoming to all. Learn more at neaalaska.org. This message sponsored by NEA Alaska.
The State Health Department sent out its last COVID-19 data summary today via email and social media. It marks a shift from focusing on case counts to tracking broader trends across the state. The department will continue to send its weekly COVID and flu update on Fridays. Alaska's Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Ann Zink, says those updates will still include COVID case counts.
But we try to put that into a larger context, where we also talk about how many people show up in the emergency department for COVID-like illness. How many people are showing up in the emergency department for influenza-like illness? How full are the hospitals in general?
Today's data summary reported 34 hospitalizations and 546 resident cases in the last week. Zink says it's become harder to track case numbers as home tests have become more popular. Those results don't always get reported to the state.
It's become increasingly problematic as we have so many more home testing, and why we need to use it in combination with other data sources to give Alaskans the best sense that they can of kind of the overall transmission and respiratory illnesses in their community at any given time.
Zink says there are important differences between COVID and the flu to keep in mind when it comes to risk level. Older Alaskans are still at the highest risk for severe illness and death due to COVID, while flu carries increased risk for both the very young and the very old.
People should consider getting flu vaccines now, anyone 6 months and older, particularly the young and the old, or honestly, people who interact with the young and the old, which is a lot of us.
The bivalent COVID booster, which teaches the immune system to fight both the original COVID strain and the Omicron variant, has been available for about 2 weeks. Health officials say it's safe to get the booster and the flu vaccine at the same time. Zink says she recommends getting a flu shot by the end of October, and as fall turns to winter, she says taking care of your mental and physical health is extra important. Collecting meticulous data during a pandemic can help determine how diseases spread and how to stop them. Reporter Sharon Lafreniere traveled to Alaska for a New York Times investigation that shows that COVID-19 data here and across the nation is lost or unusable due to underinvestment in public health. KTOO's Claire Strempel spoke with her.
What's the data failure and how did it happen?
We didn't spend money to modernize the state and local health departments. We left them with the spreadsheets, telephones, fax machines, Excel sheets, the old system. I think many people don't understand, and I certainly didn't understand until I got into this, how behind state and local health departments are in data. They're way behind.
You wrote that the low vaccine rate contributed to the heavy death toll in the United States from COVID-19, but so did the lack of data. Why is that deadly?
So, I mean, nobody can pinpoint, we lost XX million, you know, XX number of people, or so many other people, you know, were severely, became severely ill from COVID because we didn't have data. But basically what happened is that the fact that the data pipeline, if you think of the digital pipeline, is totally riddled with holes and obstacles, and it doesn't flow, means that the government did not respond as quickly as it could have, because to some degree, you know, they were flying a little bit blind.
What made you come to Alaska to tell this story?
two reasons. One, Alaska State Health Department is a pretty hard-charging health department, and it has a lot of talented people in it. Secondly, because its problems are quite typical.
What was the atmosphere like when you were here? You know, what did you see? Did anything kind of stand out to you while you were reporting?
People were in on the weekends working on data. They were working on it at night. They were, you know, coming in early, trying to make the data systems work better. I thought that it was a really talented and very dedicated staff, just working on a shoestring, right? A lot of the case reports were coming in over the fax machine, which was on the fifth floor of the health department in the epidemiology section in a corner. And every night it would run out of paper, and they'd have to come in the morning, fill it up with more paper, then carry these stacks of case reports over to a computer to enter them all by hand. So it was a massive effort. It's just like the average health department, they don't have enough resources.
What are the consequences of using trained epidemiology staff to do a bunch of manual data entry? You know, what could they have been doing instead? And what did epi staff in Alaska have to say about this?
So, I mean, that to me was one of the more troubling things, is that if you, think of it like if your phone didn't sync with your computer, right? Then you enter your information in the phone, you got to enter it again in the computer. That's what was happening here. A whole bunch of people had to be roped in to re-enter information because the databases could not connect with each other. So the health department was forced to basically reduce some of its most highly trained epidemiologists for periods of time simply to enter data. And so they would do it on weekends, they would do it at nights, they would start at 6 a.m. in the morning, and that's not unusual. I mean, the disturbing thing about it is people put in all that effort, and then it really, a lot of it didn't come, wasn't useful.
In your reporting, did anyone you spoke to have a sense of how we fix it?
You fix it by money. The government needs to spend, you know, billions of dollars for states and local health departments to upgrade their systems.
That was New York Times investigative reporter Sharon Lafreniere talking to KTOO's Claire Strempel. Pentagon officials have taken another step toward building a small nuclear power plant for Eielson Air Force Base in Interior, Alaska. On Monday, they released a request for proposals that invites prospective contractors to outline how they design, build, and deploy a so-called micro-reactor at Eielson within 5 years. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Air Force officials announced last year that they'd selected Eielson as the site of a pilot project that would prove the viability of small-scale nuclear power plants to provide a reliable backup source of electricity for military installations. And on Monday, the Air Force and Defense Logistics Agency jointly announced they'd released a request for proposals for the project.
This is really about energy resilience.
Former Air Force Deputy Assistant Secretary for Environment, Safety, and Infrastructure Mark Correll said last November that the project at Eielson is intended to help demonstrate a microreactor's capability to provide power in case the base's main source of electricity, a 70-year-old coal-fired power plant, goes offline.
We're looking to make sure that at any point in time, any of our bases with any mission will have the power it needs, where it needs it, when it needs it, in the quantities that it needs it, to assure that we can continue to do the defense mission that we have.
There's both a geopolitical reason as well as an energy resilience reason, which is why Eielson is so exciting.
Lucian Niemeyer is a principal with the United Coalition for Advanced Nuclear Power, a Washington, D.C.-based organization that advocates for nuclear-powered electrical generation. Niemeyer says the Eielson microreactor may demonstrate that the technology holds promises for the interior's other remotely located military installations.
Eielson relies on a coal plant with oil backup in a very critical area of the country.
Critical because of the area's national security assets, like Eielson's two squadrons of advanced F-35 fighters and Fort Wainwright's rapidly deployable 11th Airborne units, as well as the two missile defense installations at Fort Greely and Clear Space Force Station.
Nuclear power can serve a significant capability to run these critical bases and assets on reliable power for a period of 5 to 10 years without refuel.
The Air Force DoD request for proposals calls for construction of a facility to accommodate a micronuclear reactor that would generate up to 5 megawatts and operate for 10 years until its fuel is spent. The plan calls for construction to begin in 3 years and for the reactor to begin generating power in 2027. Niemeyer says the Pentagon and industry likely will learn a lot from how the facility performs.
But I think the lessons we learn from that are going to drive maybe a decision to start looking at other locations.
Eielson officials say they're hopeful the technology will ensure a power failure won't endanger base operations. The officials released a statement Tuesday in response to the RFP that says, quote, "We are excited to be hosting the microreactor pilot program. It will be an important first step toward developing the next generation energy technology needed for energy resilience at Eielson Air Force Base." Air Force officials say they'll conduct a conference and site visit to Eielson on October 12th for industry representatives considering submitting proposals for the project. In Delta Junction, I'm Tim Ellis.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, maintaining and operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 45 years. More at alyeskapipeline.com. Everyone knows eating fruits and veggies promotes a long and healthy life. It's important to make every bite count. Alaskans are lucky to have greens and berries from the land, as well as fresh, frozen, and canned. When it comes to living a long and healthy life, remember, every bite counts. This message sponsored by USDA SNAP Ed.
Southeast Alaska's economy saw a massive rebound in 2021 and has continued to recover from the pandemic this year. That's according to Rain Coast Data's latest annual report for the Economic Development Group Southeast Conference. But as KRBD's Eric Stone reports, there's concern that vanishing state jobs and a lack of housing could weigh on the continued recovery.
Let's start with the good news. 2020 was so bad that just about anything looks good by comparison. Not only did the pandemic grind the economy to a halt and crush the tourism sector, it was also one of the worst years for Southeast Alaska's fishing industry on record. The owner and director of Rain Coast Data, Melanie Shivens, says it's impossible to imagine a better year-over-year recovery in jobs, wages, and visitation.
It's so nice to be able to watch the economy bouncing back and see those job numbers coming back and those wages coming back. And there's so much positivity looking forward.
Shivens says that as the tourism season winds down, she's expecting the total number of passengers in Southeast Alaska to come in at just over 1 million. That's the fourth highest number on record. And she says next year could be a record breaker.
The cruise industry itself is saying, look for a season that's similar to that 2019 season. So that was 1.33 million passengers. And, but we're going to have more ships and more sailings. And so I'm expecting it to be probably our biggest season ever.
Another highlight is the construction sector. With federal infrastructure money coming into Alaska following the passage of a bipartisan bill last year, Shivens is expecting another big year for builders. But the shining star of the 2021 economy was the seafood sector. It wasn't exactly a banner year for the industry in terms of the total weight harvested and the value of the catch. Last year's haul was just ahead of the 10-year average, but both of those metrics more than doubled from 2020.
It really came back and supported the economy. And actually, in 2021, our seafood sector was our number one wage provider in Southeast Alaska. And that was for the first time since 2015.
That's among private sector industries. The top wage provider for Southeast Alaskans was, as usual, the government. The public sector provided about a third of workers' total earnings in 2021. But Shivens says she's worried about a growing trend, state jobs leaving the region or disappearing altogether.
If you look at the last 10 years, state jobs in Southeast Alaska have decreased by 24%. And that is it. That is a lot of jobs. And those jobs are good paying jobs with benefits attached to them.
According to the report, state authorities have cut 65% of the Department of Public Safety's jobs in Southeast Alaska and 62% from the Alaska court system. Jobs with the state education and transportation departments are down by about half, as are University of Alaska jobs in the region. Total employment in all sectors is down 12% from pre-pandemic levels across the region as of this June. That's in part because employers in the tourism sector can't fill open jobs. Shivens says the lack of available housing in the region is playing prominently in the labor shortage.
We've got this sort of labor housing shortage that we're seeing across Southeast Alaska. And I'm putting them together because that's how our business leaders are describing them.
More than 60% of business leaders say rental and home prices are too high for their staff. A similar fraction say there are simply not enough homes on the market. The shortages are most pronounced in Hoonah, Sitka, Ketchikan, and Skagway, according to the survey. And construction is not meeting demand. Shivan's data shows that the number of housing units permitted and completed actually fell by almost 20% last year.
We know that the cost of construction has gone up, and so maybe that's has put people off.
Despite the warning signs, though, business leaders are optimistic. Nearly 80% say they have a positive outlook for the next year. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Eric Stone.
Ketchikan High School was recently chosen as the only high school in Alaska with the rights to perform the Broadway version of the Disney musical Frozen. KRBD's Reagan Miller reports.
Students in Tommy Verlakosak's drama class say they didn't know their teacher had applied for the grant that would win the K-High Drama Kings Club the rights to Frozen and put them among the first students in the country to do so. Sophomore Neela Urquhart is hoping to join the cast. Urquhart has about 7 local theater productions under her belt already. When I caught up with her, she was waiting to audition for yet another production. She's hoping to add Frozen to the list.
I like everything about it. I like the costumes, singing, dancing, everything.
She says that her teacher, Tommy Verlakosak, had been hinting at the big reveal for some time.
Mr. BK did not tell us anything about it. He said it was supposed to be a secret.
The United States of Frozen contest is a collaboration of the Educational Theater Association, the Disney Theatrical Group, and Music Theater International. A total of 51 schools were chosen for a grant, one in each state plus Puerto Rico.
There's all these questions about how my students in our organization embodies the concept or the idea of love as an open door.
That's a nod to one of the songs in the 2013 Disney movie.
Love is an open door.
This is kind of our second year as an actual program at this school. And so I really, really leaned into that because last year what these kids showed me and showed, I think, our community and the school is that they are an open door and they have been so accepting of anyone who wants to try this out.
He learned Ketchikan High School had won the contest late last month, but had to keep the secret until the official announcement came out on September 9th.
And I was so scared that one of the students was going to see it online somewhere, but somehow it slipped past all of them.
That's when he was able to tell the students and their families. He estimates that it saves the school between $6,000 and $7,000, money that can now be used on more elaborate sets and costumes. Freshman Elena Etten knows the show pretty well. She was Elsa in the junior production. She's hoping to make the cast for the full show.
It was pretty fun. I got to learn a lot more about myself musically, and I'm really excited to be able to do that with this production as well.
Verlakosak expects to cast the main roles by the end of the school year and perform the show next fall. An opening date has not been set. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Reagan Miller.
That's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Chris Clint and Liz Ruskin in Anchorage, Will McCarthy in Hooper Bay, Claire Strempel in Juneau, Tim Ellis in Delta Junction, and Eric Stone and Reagan Miller in Ketchikan. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Tobin Shelby, Katie Anastas is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. Monies generated through estate and deferred gifts enable public radio to provide our listeners, you, with the level of programming excellence you've come to expect. It may also reduce income and estate taxes. Consult your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.